I am really so incredibly honored and thrilled to be here today. And I do want to start by saying thank you for what has been a rare opportunity to serve in elected office. And it's an incredible honor and something that I really took incredibly seriously. And I want to thank my friend Trey for inviting me. And also, can we give Tabitha a hand? Because she really has done a great job. Thank you, Tabitha, for all of your help in organizing everything. I thought that I would focus my talk today on three specific areas. I will talk a little bit about my personal life and my personal walk with Christ. Then I want to talk about what happens on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and how faith really does keep the faith, y'all, because it does exist up there. And then finally, I'll try to offer some thoughts to each of you on, you know, how we can be productive in the place of public policy, because I do think that as Christians, we are called to have a voice in that arena and doing all that we can to really elevate political discourse. And then after that, I will take some questions. Some of you in the room know me fairly well. Jerry over there knows me quite well. I am not really a person who wears my faith totally out on my arm. So I have some notes for this because, candidly, I'm a little bit nervous about this speech. But my faith has always been a very, very big part of my life. As a teenager, I didn't even really know how impactful my faith was in the moment that I turned to it. And I suspect that a lot of young people are like that. So I had a very difficult home life. My mother was extremely ill, an alcoholic. Looking back now, I'm sure she had some mental illness as well. My father, I always grappled with whether or not Daddy was the strongest person I'd ever met or the weakest person I ever met. He worked super hard, but, you know, when you have a family that's falling apart, my sister, who is 10 years younger than I am, was born with a very serious birth defect. She was missing her entire esophagus. You know, God works incredible miracles. Just because of his plan, she was born just 15 minutes from Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. They were able to get her over there. And lo and behold, there was a brilliant young surgeon there from Macon, ironically, who was working on a breakthrough surgery to use a piece of intestine to correct this birth defect. And my sister and another little boy, Toby, born about the same time, are the first two babies that have grown up to lead normal lives and survive that particular defect with that surgery. Fast forward, and so as you can imagine, the strain on the family was very, very heavy. Jennifer was in the hospital for most of the first 3 years of her life. Financially, things were very difficult. And by the time I was 14, 15, things really were spinning completely out of control. And I always have my go-to scripture at that time. And again, I really didn't. We went to church every Sunday as a family, but I wouldn't say that I was particularly spiritual. But in those really dark moments, when there was fighting and, you know, physical abuse and things of that nature, Jeremiah 29:11 was always what I turned to. For I know the plans I have for you, to prosper you, to grow you, to give you hope and a future. And even on the worst of moments, like the night that I left home for good when my mother put a rifle to my head, I called to that scripture. And for every bit, if you follow my career, I've had some super incredible highs, y'all, and then some really amazing disappointments. But through it all, I've always believed deep in my heart that God really does have a plan for each and every one of us. And on a lot of days, we don't know what the plan is, but if we just trust, It will be, and it is, the best and most right and glorious plan that he can have for each and every one of us. So on the crazy roller coaster ride of my life, prayer and faith really helped me in a lot of the decision making. So some of you may remember my time. Well, before I get to that, one other place where my faith really came to play. So my husband and I, it's kind of how I got into public office, I think. My husband and I tried for 10 years just about to have a child. And when I was 39, we really had to make the decision that we had to cross that bridge and know that there had to be a different life for us. It would be different, but it could still be great. But it was probably even, gosh, you look back and you think, you just up and leave home at 17. I stayed with a friend and got a job and all that. Nothing compared to the heartbreak of having to let go of a dream of having a baby of my own. Nothing. And I really did not think that I was going to get through that. But I did, because I believed that God had a plan for me. And it would be different, but it could still be glorious. But I had to choose to believe in that plan. So I held my husband's hand. We crossed the bridge to a new and different life. And to his great credit, that man stayed with me, because a whole lot of lesser men would have left. And I love him for that. About a year after that, I am randomly approached to run for public office. And when I say randomly, I mean completely randomly. I had absolutely no interest, no desire. It had never even crossed my mind. And I came out and I told my husband, I said, yeah, Mike Ken's chief of staff came to me today and took me to lunch and said, I need to run for county commission. I said, I think that's a crazy idea. My husband looked at me and said, and Mike Doherty over here knows Steve well, he looked at me and goes, I can kind of sort of see you doing that. Well, I ran. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I really didn't. This is how naive and dumb I was the first time I ran. I ran against Rob Pitts, who had just lost the runoff against Shirley Franklin for mayor. Now, he won. He did not kick my butt. I only lost by 3,000 votes, which these 2,500, 3,000 vote margins is a theme in my life. What can I say? But, so I just went on my merry way, and it was my husband, it was our 10th wedding anniversary. We were in Hawaii, and next thing you know, I got a call to come and be Sonny Perdue's deputy chief of staff, which I did. 7 months later, Mike Ken resigns as chairman. Sonny Perdue says, well, obviously, Karen, you are the natural to run for chairman. You just ran not even a year ago countywide. Let's go make this happen. And then I win. It's really unbelievable. And so for anyone in this room who at a low moment or a dark day doesn't believe that God has a plan, all you have to do is just think about the craziness of my world, and it is really that wondrous. But my faith and my prayer really came, and prayer came into play for me within 3 months of being elected county commission chairman. Commissioner Bob Fulton passed away unexpectedly. I felt completely alone. He was my mentor. I'm chairman, but still, I mean, I was 41 years old. I'd never been in politics. I've got a fractious board. Had a good head on my shoulders, but nonetheless, it was a lot to manage. And then all of a sudden, he was gone. At that same time is when I discovered that then Sheriff Jackie Barrett had stolen $7 million of taxpayer funds. So, and Jackie was very, very prominent at the time. As some of you may remember, she was the first African-American female elected sheriff in the country. She had just been named National Sheriff of the Year. And along comes this young whippersnapper from North Fulton calling her out. And so I chatted with her and I said, listen, this is untenable. It's $7 million and you have to put it back. And if you put it back, then it's going to be a different scenario. So let's just give it 10 days and then we'll see what happens. So 10 days come and go and nothing. So I was faced with the decision around what I was going to do. I knew that if I called for her resignation, that I would ignite a real firestorm and it would be very racial in nature. But that's what had to happen. And I had a spiritual coach at the time, Dr. Alan Hunt, and we chatted a lot about it. And Mike Bowers, former Attorney General Mike Bowers, was also a great source of strength for me. And I had to decide, what kind of elected official was I going to be? Was I going to be just a politician who just goes along to get along, or was I really going to be an elected leader and do everything in my power to right a wrong? And I decided I wanted to be the latter. So I thought I was gracious in asking her to resign. I tried not to be shrill about it. She would not. So then I made it my business. She was a constitutional officer. I read the Georgia State Code. And let me tell y'all, that is one boring book. And it is big, to find the path that would be a legal path to remove her from office. And ultimately, I found that. But on the day that I had to make the press announcement, I sat in my office and literally prayed to God that I would have the strength and the right tone to do what was being asked of me. Photo ID was another difficult one where I wanted to be sure that I did it exactly right, in the best interest of every citizen in Georgia. And that meant that I had to convince the legislature to give me $1 million to do the implementation and the outreach across the state, and to be sure that I conducted myself in a way that was above reproach. Because remember, the first year that we did photo ID was the year that President Barack Obama was on the ballot. Again, it was very, very contentious at that time. Every Republican presidential candidate in the country wanted the first Republican Secretary of State's endorsement. And I think this was a good decision. I refrained from getting involved in any of the presidential politics that year because my job had a higher calling than the raw politics of it. And let me tell you, some of these guys, they pulled out all the stops. Mitt Romney found out that I love Donny Osmond. And I do love me some Donny Osmond, y'all. I do. I love Donny. Although I found out that he's a New England Patriots fan, and that kind of hurt my heart, but that's all right. Mitt Romney literally arranged for Donny Osmond to call me. And even Donny Osmond asking me to engage would not get me to engage. So today, after losing in November, I am personally regrouping, professionally regrouping, and, you know, it's so funny how things go full circle. And so here I am once again turning to Jeremiah 29, for I know the plans for you. I want to talk a little bit about faith in the halls of Congress. I'm sure that every one of you in this room think that it's just this completely rudderless, you know, crazy place. But I am here to tell you that faith and prayer really does have a very, very strong presence in Washington and throughout the halls of Congress. A couple of things that take place. There are multiple, I can think of four right off the top, bipartisan prayer groups that exist. A men's group, a women's group, and two mixed groups. And you will notice I said bipartisan. The prayer groups are one of the, really, if I try to think about it, other than an issue caucus or an industry caucus, the prayer groups are the only formal sort of venues, if you will, platforms where it is bipartisan. And in the one group, normally we have, we'll sometimes have outside speakers, or a member will get up and talk about his or her faith and how they try to deploy their faith in their work. Then there was a personal prayer group that I participated in with a group of Republican women. In the way the cadence works in DC, you have a fly-in week, and the first day that you arrive in DC, you have votes at night at 6:30. So we met every fly-in evening at 6 p.m. There are eight of us, and there's a really wonderful chapel just off the rotunda of the Capitol outside of the speaker's office. And we met there each fly-in evening at 6 p.m. and just talked about how it was going, and because there's so, for the women, there was not that many of us, so we really felt like we wanted to have a good camaraderie. And we came from, it will amaze you the walks of life that different members of Congress come from. And, you know, we've had my friend Jackie Walorski, she and her husband were missionaries for over a decade. Kathy McMorris Rogers is the mom of a special needs child. Jamie Butler from Oregon, she was told that her baby would never survive, and she decided to, and that she should abort it. She said, absolutely not, I'm going to have this child, and her child is five now. We've got Debbie Lesko from Arizona, who survived just incredible abuse from her spouse, to come out of that and be a member of Congress. Jeff Fortenberry, just an amazing, from Nebraska. I would call him he is kind of the soul of the GOP conference, if you will. Every week we would meet in a conference with leadership. This would, again, just be the Republicans. And every single meeting was always opened with prayer from one of the members. And that was really enriching as well for my walk with Jesus, because it was just fascinating to me to hear just the different approaches to prayer that the various members would take. So I will say that my observation was that a great many of the members on both sides of the aisle really do participate in the prayer groups and rely on their faith. I won't kid you, though. There are, you know, those on both sides of the political aisle, and it was really disturbing to me that would, I'll characterize it as misusing their Christianity and their faith. And what I mean by that is either with great hypocrisy or almost weaponizing their faith for the raw sake of politics, which was really quite disturbing. And, you know, that was all designed to get a moment in time, you know, with the press and things of that nature. But you should know that most people really are working very, very hard to do the best right thing with their faith. I also, in the third piece, and then I'll do some questions, but I do think that our faith can be a catalyst for improving the political discourse in the country. And, you know, what I mean by that is, so we are all called, right, to live our faith out in all the things that we do day in and day out of each day. And I think that that translates as well over to public policy and our faith. Some would argue that their separation of church and state would strictly preclude this. I think that's just a misinterpretation and a broadening of the scope of separation of church and state. I look at it that our faith must inform our political opinions. It must, if we are going to be Christians and really live our walk with Christ day in and day out. And so how do we do that? Engagement, I think, is really the first step. I won't ask anybody to raise your hand, but I'm willing to bet that there are at least a handful of people in this room that have not voted, and that's terrible, so you should ask forgiveness for that. secondly, because look, these are important times right now, and we all have an obligation not just as Christians, but as Americans as well, to be informed and involved and vote. Education on the issues is also important. And one of the most frequently asked questions I get, I think at CEO NetWeavers, they ask this, well, how are we supposed to get information that's real and factual? Because I'm here to tell you, whether you watch Fox or MSNBC or CNN, if you read The Times, The Wall Street Journal, all those things, everybody is driven, all of the media, they are driven by clicks, they are driven by ratings, and that's just how it works. And so, and with the 24/7 news hour, it's just jamming everything in there, and a lot of these issues are complex, and they do not lend themselves to a 30-second soundbite. So what do you do? One, you should get the newsletter. I know Senator Isaacson sends out a newsletter. I am guessing that Representative McBath, that she will begin to do so as well. Some of you probably got mine when I was in office. I wrote those myself, especially when it was the big issues like immigration reform and things of that nature, because it was important for you to hear in my voice what the thought process was for that. I always try to, when I'm looking at the issues, I don't want to hear just who supports something. I want to know who doesn't support it and why. So as you're sorting through some of the issues, I think that's one approach that you can take, and to be sure that you do have both sides of the issue from all of the different perspectives on an issue, because, you know, we're all infallible. You're not going to get all the information. And voting, as I said. But I think as Christians, we also have a much higher obligation than just being engaged, educated, and voting. We are called to emulate Jesus Christ in our lives. We are called to bring the teachings to life. And that means we are called to be active on these issues. So one of the scriptures that I turn to a lot, and on my day to give a prayer to the conference, is 2 Timothy, where Paul wrote that, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear and timidity, but of power, love, and self-discipline." And remember Timothy. Timothy did not want to be the out front leader in the Christian movement, right? But he had to find his power. He had to overcome his fear so that he could answer God's call for him. And that's what we have to do, particularly in these times. So on the power front of it, you know, you guys are all very influential people in your worlds, and you have the ability to go out and really persuade people with good reason, reasoning on the issues. But on the flip side, employing our God-given power is not about perpetual outrage. It is not about, quote, resist and outrage out there. And don't get me wrong. There are certainly issues that are rightly deserving of our outrage. The turning a blind eye to sexual abuse and harassment over the past couple of decades, for sure. And that will motivate change, etc. But not everything is outrageous. And I feel like we live a little bit in a culture of outrage, and that, you know, people so quickly let anger turn into fury and hatred, whether it's, you know, leaving a nasty note for the person who, you know, oh my gosh, they parked over the white line on the parking space, or, you know, just every single thing that if you're a Democrat, you're bad. If you're a Republican, you're bad. And everything you do is outrageous. Being outraged over an election loss. Sometimes things just happen. And if we go back and believe God has a plan, then, you know, let's just all live day to day. I'll give you one example of something that caused some outrage, and then I'll quickly move on. So in Congress, the party that is in majority has a speakership. So, and the person who sits in the speaker's chair rotates among all the members. So it's my turn. So I'm in the speaker's chair, I'm just doing everything, and up walks Representative Ted Lieu from California. By all accounts, a nice guy. I didn't know what, you know what happened. Next thing I know, he starts playing audio on the floor of the House, of the which it turned out not to be true, of the children crying over the separations at from family at the borders. That is blatantly a violation of house rules. So I say, gentleman is out of order. He doesn't listen. He refuses to listen, and I didn't know what else to do, so I'm looking at the parliamentarian going, So finally, they talk with him, and he is not forcibly removed from the floor. Like, literally, the parliamentarian, totally nonpartisan, was going to have to remove him forcibly from the floor. Okay, so fast forward. I'm like, oh, my gosh, what a luck of the draw on that. Just sitting there, just thinking I'm just going to go, the gentleman is recognized for 5 minutes. That's it. That was all I was supposed to have to do up there, and then everything blew up. Fast forward, that was on a Thursday. I get home on Friday. The, quote, outrage over simply trying to enforce the rules was crazy. Death threats. Our home address was tweeted and put up not once but twice. I still, as you can tell, don't really have the words to really very well encapsulate how that blew up the way that it did. And oh, by the way, I was the only person on the Republican side of the Georgia delegation, and I was the third person to speak up and say that the family separations were unacceptable, and as compassionate Americans, we could do better, and we had an obligation to do better. But that was lost in all of that. And I share all that because when people are angry, when we are angry all the time, it clouds our judgment. You wouldn't go out and negotiate the biggest deal of your life from a position of fury, would you? No, because you probably wouldn't do a very good job at it. And so everybody running around, including the people who are elected, mad all the time, it is really the biggest hurdle that we have to problem solving up there. And the last two things I'll touch on, love and self-discipline. The Bible calls us to love our neighbor as ourselves. So when we disagree, it should just be a disagreement. It shouldn't be that you're evil because I don't like your idea, or I'm evil because you don't like my idea. We just simply disagree. And I think we just really have to take a step back sometimes and really look at issues through the eyes of the other person. I had to do that a lot on the Fulton County Commission, and it helped me so much. And I recognized that Commissioner Emma Darnell had led a very different life than I did. And so she came at the issues from a perspective that I had to try really hard to understand. But when I did that, we were able to, on most things, find some common ground. Respect, even when we disagree, and humility. Because changing hearts and changing minds and finding common ground, it does require compassion and empathy. And I'll use a pro-life issue as an example. So, you know, when I had that blow up at Komen with Planned Parenthood, I wrote a book and went out and talked with a lot of the pro-life groups and made speeches. And one thing that I observed is that too often, as we were trying to convince people to be pro-life, it was done in a way that was lacking in compassion, and it was too shrill. And I simply said, I would like for people to consider that in 1972, when Roe v. Wade was decided and abortion became illegal, and it would surprise you, I have a stat, something like 50% of women over 60 have had an abortion. So when we are out talking about that issue and calling murder and murderer, we're saying to that woman that she's a murderer. Now, we are called to give forgiveness. We don't have to approve of the deed, but I would submit to you that in the 70s and the early 80s, women didn't have sonograms. Goodness, we have 4D sonograms now. So hearts and minds are being changed, and I believe that those women, knowing what they know now, in the darkness of the night, they are remorseful because they're looking in the eyes of their grandchildren now. Respect. The Bible tells us we're supposed to respect our elected leaders, yet a whole lot of people exercise a whole lot of unchristian-like behavior out there, whether it is about Nancy Pelosi or about Donald Trump. And we are supposed to pray authentically for our leaders. And that means, no, you don't pray that something bad happens to Nancy Pelosi. No, you don't pray that Donald Trump is going to be indicted. Now, maybe we should pray that he tweets a little less. That could be helpful. But that kind of tolerance and prayer for our leaders is really very important. In closing, God is in control. God is in control. There were those who thought that the world as we knew it would end when President Obama was elected. And there are those who think that the world is going to end because Donald Trump was elected. Not going to happen. God is in control. So this is not a time for us to be afraid and timid. Rather, this is the time for great strength and greater faith. And I'm going to end where I began, for I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you, plans to grow you, not harm you, to give you hope and a future. Be hopeful. Choose to be hopeful for the great and bright and wonderful future for each of you and for this really awesome nation. Thank y'all. God bless.